Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group presents the following recording of a conference call briefing on pending financial services reform proposals that was held on May 10, 2010. As always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon and welcome to our conference call. This is Dean Reuter of the Federalist Society. I'm director of the Federalist Society's practice groups, and I'm happy to welcome you here today. For those of you who have just dialed in, it's my pleasure to welcome you. This is our call on financial services reform. Let me note for you that your telephone is currently muted, and we're going to begin our conference call momentarily. First, a disclaimer. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. We hope this briefing call, like all of our programming, will serve to stimulate discussion and further exchange on this topic. And just to note that this call is being recorded for later use. After some opening remarks by our three participants, we're going to have a question and answer session during which you'll be permitted to ask questions. At that point, you're going to hear a prompt that we're beginning the question and answer session, and you'll be given directions on how to use your telephone to ask a question. And now let me introduce the speakers very, very briefly so we can get right to the program. John Douglas is a partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell, heading the firm's bank regulatory practice. He's a former general counsel of the FDIC. Bert Ely is principal in Ely & Company. He's an expert on monetary policy and regulation of banking and financial services. And Peter Wallison holds the Arthur F. Burns Chair in Financial Policy Studies and is co-director of AEI's Program on Financial Markets Deregulation. He's former general counsel of the United States Treasury Department and former White House counsel to President Ronald Reagan. So with that, let me turn it over to John Douglas, and you can get us started, John.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you, Peter and Bert. We're getting ready to witness another round of legislation following a crisis. We've had this before. It seems to be the driving force behind most financial institutions' regulation. And this one, I think, is particularly interesting. Among the interesting facets is that there is a council set up trying to discern the causes of this crisis. That council won't reach its conclusions for some several months now, and probably not even this year, but the lack of conclusions and consensus around the causes is not going to slow Congress down in terms of remedying whatever those causes might have been. This is a bit like walking into a casino in Las Vegas and seeing a lot of tables where different games are being played. We have games around systemic risk. We have games around what financial institutions should do. We have games around regulatory restructuring. We have games around all sorts of other interesting things, consumer protection and so on. We're going to talk today about some of the major aspects of this bill. We won't get into all of it. We only have an hour. We're going to start by turning to Peter, and we're going to address sort of the systemically important institutions and what Congress is thinking about doing to those institutions. And so, Peter, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, John. Let me just talk very, very quickly about this commission that is supposed to be reporting on the causes of the financial crisis, because I happen to be a member of that commission. And one of the quite remarkable things about it is that Congress set this up, but is, as John suggested, going ahead and legislating without waiting for the commission to tell it what caused the financial crisis. So that says something about the seriousness with which Congress is, and the administration, for that matter, is approaching this whole question of understanding what this is all about before actually prescribing some kind of fix. In any event, that commission is supposed to report in December, and by that time we will probably have a result out of Congress. I'm going to talk about two things that are now on the floor in the Senate. You see them probably every day in the newspapers, about the debate that is going on in the Senate over financial regulation. There are two titles in this Senate legislation that I will review as quickly and as fully as I can in the time we have. The first, under Title I, talks about the regulation of systemically important companies. No one really has a very good idea of what a systemically important company is. It's never been satisfactorily defined, and it's one of those things that people say, well, I actually can't define it, but I know it when I see it. The theory is that a systemically important company, if it fails, will somehow have a major impact on the functioning of the financial markets or the economy as a whole. It will create perhaps some instability in the market if it fails, and many people point to the failure of Lehman Brothers as an example of what happens when a systemically important firm goes into bankruptcy. So what Title I of this bill does is it allows the Federal Reserve to regulate all systemically important companies that will be selected for regulation by a council of regulators. And that will include not just banks, of course, but all kinds of non-banks, such as hedge funds, insurance holding companies, finance companies, securities firms, other companies engaged in any major respect in financial activities. So the Fed will become kind of a super regulator for all of the companies that have been designated for regulation by the Fed under this procedure. To me, this is one of the most troubling provisions of this law, not only because I think it is extremely difficult to determine when a company is systemically important, gives the Fed kind of a carte blanche to regulate any company that it chooses to regulate, kind of a roving regulator throughout the economy, and because it's almost impossible to imagine that any regulatory agency will be able to do an effective job in regulating companies that have completely different business models. A hedge fund is not anything like a bank holding company, and a bank holding company isn't anything like a finance company or a securities firm. So the fact that the Fed is going to have the authority to regulate not only capital, but liquidity, leverage, and activities really means that it will be able to adjudicate among, as a regulatory matter, among a whole series of companies that are competing with one another. It's almost unimaginable that that can be done by a regulatory agency. In Title II, there have been some, that title has not been challenged. Title I has not been challenged yet by anyone, and it looks as though it may go through the Senate without any effort to amend it by the Republicans or anyone else. But Title II has been amended in major respects. In an agreement between the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Dodd, and the ranking member, Senator Shelby, adopted last week, some major changes were made in Title II. Title II was put into place for the purpose of permitting these large, systemically important companies to be resolved without going to bankruptcy. And there was a lot of concern that it provided an opportunity for what would in effect be sort of a permanent TARP. That is to say, if any of these companies got into trouble, the government would step in and solve them, actually giving their creditors many advantages over the creditors of smaller companies that were certainly going to be going into bankruptcy. But the changes that have now been made in Title II actually do reduce the likelihood of that to some degree. Originally, Title II had a $50 billion fund set up in advance, paid for by large financial institutions, and that fund would have been usable by the FDIC to bail out any one of these very large companies should it get into trouble. That fund has now been removed. In addition, as many of you know, during the financial crisis, it was one of the things the government did through the FDIC was to guarantee the obligations of a number of financial institutions. In fact, those guarantees were very, very substantial, running into the trillions of dollars. And in the new amendment to Title II, guarantees like that cannot be undertaken by the government without the approval of Congress in advance. In addition, any resolution process that is begun by the FDIC requires the recoupment from anyone who is paid out as a creditor of any funds they receive that is more than they would have gotten in an ordinary bankruptcy. This is a very important provision. If it can work, it will be a very important provision because it will prevent a lot of the moral hazard that might have occurred if creditors of these very large companies actually receive benefits that they would not have received if the company had actually gone into bankruptcy. Now, there are several more provisions that have been adopted for Title II, but I don't want to take too much of the time available here, and maybe we can talk about them during the question period or when my colleagues raise some questions after I finish. So with that, I'll just say that the only remaining thing I want to talk about is that the Federal Reserve has a lot of flexibility under something called 13(3) of the Federal Reserve Act, and that allowed it to provide financing to, for example, AIG. That has been substantially restricted by the same amendment to Title II that I was talking about. So the Fed will have a lot less in the way of discretion to use its funds in the future. Thanks very much.
Peter, we should talk a little bit and maybe a couple of aspects of systemically important institutions I think are worth pointing out. One of the big differences between the House bill and the Senate bill was surrounds the rules that would be applied in the event of the sort of insolvency or receivership of one of these institutions. When the House first did its bill, it essentially adopted the FDIC receivership rules on a wholesale basis. Those rules are interesting. They apply to banks. But there are some significant differences between those rules and the rules that would apply in a bankruptcy. As an example, and just as a simple example, the FDIC is supposed to honor security interests in a receivership. However, it's given the authority to avoid a security interest taken in contemplation of insolvency. Most lenders believe that that security interests are necessarily taken in contemplation of insolvency. And there was a substantial worry that if the FDIC were given its broad, relatively unfettered discretion over creditors that is inherent in the FDIC process, and that were to be applied to some of these systemically important institutions, adoption of these rules would in fact exacerbate the very liquidity problems that were driving these institutions into insolvency anyway. So one of the significant changes in the Senate bill, which has been pretty important, is to move more closely to bankruptcy-like rules. And yet it seems to me that there's still an inherent, distinction between institutions that are deemed to be systemically important and thus subject to this special resolution authority and those that might not be. Can you kind of sort of give me your thoughts on what sort of dangers this might create from a sort of financial or economic or societal perspective?
Well, in this case, I think we have to wait to see what the FDIC actually does with the statutory language when this legislation is finally completed and adopted by both houses. But I suspect that the Senate provisions here will probably be the ones that ultimately survive. And if so, the provisions in the Senate bill now require that if any creditor receives more in the workout, in the resolution process, than that creditor would have received in an ordinary bankruptcy, there is a right on the part of the, an obligation actually on the part of the FDIC to claw back that additional amount. Now, I think that language is intended to cover the provisions you're talking about, John, because
yep.
the discretion that the FDIC has been very troublesome to people. Other institutions that are not banks, all these non-bank systemic companies, could, if treated like banks, could end up being much, their creditors could end up being much better treated than the creditors of companies that are not resolved under these provisions. So I think this clawback provision will go some distance to righting that problem or correcting that problem.
This is Bert. Peter, let me just jump in with a question about that. How will this work, or how effectively will it work, where the creditor, the party where you're trying to claw back from, is a non-U.S. Person, a non-U.S. Entity? If they have been received a payment and they're in another country and they don't have any assets in the United States, how would the clawback work?
Oh, Bert, I mean, it would be very hard to forecast that at this point. And I suppose that the FDIC, with the discretion that it has, might choose to adjust the way that it pays people off if there isn't any way to claw back any additional amount that might be paid to them, or they might set up some sort of escrow or some other way of making sure they have access to the funds if necessary. But at this point, it's very hard to predict how that will work.
I think it's also extremely hard to figure out what a Chapter 7 liquidation payment would really mean.
Yeah.
Because you're not really going through a liquidation process. Somebody at the end of the day has got to come up with some formulation of what that means and make sure that nobody got more than that. That seems to me to be a fairly formidable task.
I think it's a very, very difficult task, but my discussions with the staff of the Senate Banking Committee indicate that they discussed this issue, and I'm talking here about the minority side, the Republican side. They did discuss this issue at length with bankruptcy specialists and were told that it was possible to estimate what a particular claimant would have received in bankruptcy after the matter is completely resolved, and then to recover from each of those parties anything that they received more than the amount that they were entitled to. But I agree, this is a very tough thing to imagine.
Let me jump in with a question on another aspect of this. That is the notion of what is when is an entity too big to fail. It's somewhat contextual in terms of the nature of its business and what's happening at the time. And I think where this comes up particularly is with regard to some of the firms that are not necessarily very large in terms of assets, but have an awful lot of custodial activities and are very significant to the markets from that standpoint. How is that going to be addressed, Peter?
Well, actually, that is a very good question, and I think that the way it will work is that these companies that have important clearing and settlement functions within the system are probably going to be designated as systemically important companies. There may be a way for their clearance and settlement activities perhaps to be separated or encapsulated in some way so that they are kept separate from their other activities so that if they should have any difficulty, those clearing and settlement activities can be separated immediately, put into a bridge bank of some kind, and continue to function under the FDIC's control. But again, these things are details that are not covered so far in the statute and would have to be covered by regulations that are going to be put into effect after the legislation is adopted.
We should turn for a moment to the other side of this coin. I mean, Peter has sort of led the discussion of, you know, how Congress intends to address the too big to fail or systemically important institutions were they to get in trouble. There's another side of this coin, and that sort of represented both in the bill and in various amendments to the bill that have been bandied about, are designed to make sure that institutions don't reach the stage of being too big to fail or systemically important. It's interesting to watch these come and how they're addressed. And for instance, last week there was a proposal that came up that would have essentially imposed a size cap on the institution and would have, if enacted, required some of the largest institutions to divest down to a smaller size. The idea being that, you know, if we're going to solve too big to fail, we'll solve it by addressing the too big size of the equation. Now that that amendment got defeated, but there are other similar things that are being kicked around. For instance, there is a relatively serious proposal, which again I don't think will be enacted, to reimpose Glass-Steagall. Somehow a theory being bandied about that if it were not for Glass-Steagall, this never would have happened. I do find that fairly remarkable. But that proposal has been kicked around. Of more, more interesting and more importance in the bill itself are certain provisions that deal with sort of excessive growth and complexity. For instance, the Financial Stability Oversight Council is to monitor systemic risk and make recommendations to the Fed for increasingly strict rules for capital, leverage, liquidity, risk management, and other requirements as companies grow in size and complexity. So this is designed to, you know, kind of wring out risk from the larger institutions. The council is going to have the ability to require non-bank financial companies that pose a risk to the financial stability of the United States to submit to supervision by the Fed. Institutions we've talked a bit, or one of the things that's been discussed is the so-called Volcker Rule. This is a provision that would require regulators to implement regulations for banks, their affiliates, and bank holding companies to prohibit proprietary trading, investment in, and sponsorship of hedge funds and private equity funds, and to limit the relationships with these hedge funds and private equity funds. Non-bank financial institutions supervised by the Fed will have restrictions on their proprietary trading and hedge fund and private equity investments. The regulations are to be developed after a study by the Financial Stability Oversight Council and based on their recommendations. Again, a very interesting provision, something that, as near as anybody can tell, has no relationship whatsoever to this current financial crisis, and yet it is an idea that has traction and is likely to be enacted in some form. In fact, there's an article in today's American Banker regarding the Volcker Rule. Yes, go ahead, Bert.
John, the good news, of course, is that it's easy to define proprietary trading.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And ironically, I mean, I do find this ironic. In no place in the bill does it take away the merchant banking authority the bank holding companies have enjoyed since Glass-Steagall. I mean, since Graham Leach Bliley. I do find that remarkable. So whatever proprietary trading is, it doesn't take away the merchant banking authority of financial institutions under Graham Leach Bliley.
And of course, to those who are listening, I'm being totally facetious. In fact, it is it's extremely difficult to define what is proprietary trading as differentiated from those trading activities that are intended to serve customers. The other question that comes up is to what extent would proprietary trading, however defined, not get pushed out not just of insured depository institutions, but of holding companies they own them? Because then the question becomes one of where will that type of trading take place? And to what extent will this push out, if you will, create new systemic risk potentials.
One would have thought back before we got where we were, that the governmental interest in financial institutions would be directly related to whether their insured deposits being used to fund the activity. So, along that line, you might say, well, if proprietary trading is a problem, we'll put it in separately capitalized entities within a holding company system. But it doesn't seem to be going there. It seems to be going much farther than that, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, this is a remarkable thing, John. The House bill, if I recall correctly, has a provision that any kind of large financial activity of a company that is within an operating company, like a Caterpillar, for example, if it has a financing activity, that financing activity may have to be moved into a separate holding company of some kind, and there would be regulations placed on the relationship between the company's own financial activities and its operating activities. What they've done here, what people have done here, is taken the old idea that insured financial institutions like banks have to be treated, have to be controlled so that the taxpayers don't lose anything or the FDIC doesn't lose anything because of risk-taking, and they've now applied it, in effect, to risk-taking by any financial activity on the theory that a large financial activity could fail and cause disruption in the economy. So we are expanding an idea that was once limited to banks to all kinds of financial activities in non-banks.
And this, of course, is also extended to the whole notion of derivatives in terms of this type of push out into the ether without defining where it ends up and what risks will be created as a result of it.
Sure, and it's very hard to imagine how, for example, credit default swaps could continue without heavily capitalized large institutions functioning as the backbone of that market. Very, very hard to imagine, and if that's what occurs, we might end up with no substantial credit default swap system anymore.
Indeed, the whole derivative discussion, I mean, I realize the Federalist Society doesn't take positions on legislation. This derivatives discussion, to my mind, is an example of a bad idea run amok. the idea that somehow derivatives are bad and therefore need to be, that financial institutions shouldn't participate in them, is, to my mind, a ludicrous idea. Derivatives range from all sorts of things. On the very simple end, credit, interest rate swaps, and maybe on a more complex end, some of the credit default swaps and other things. But banking is simply risk taking, and derivatives are simply a form of risk allocation, risk shifting. And it is remarkable that there is a serious proposal on the table that would push all derivatives outside of insured depository institutions.
The Congress Senate does not seem to recognize that credit default swaps are really no different from loans.
And
at some point in the future, they may decide that banks shouldn't really be engaged in that risky business of making loans either.
Indeed. If one were going to drive risk out of the banking system, we would go back to the narrow bank where you accept deposits, you invest in treasuries.
Remember Bob's Bank in Lake Wobegon? Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
And that's where we're headed.
That was their motto.
Well, if I could just add to that, too, to the extent that you get that type of push out in U.S. financial institutions, obviously one of the first places to push it is into the financial institutions of other countries, such as Canada. And in effect, what Congress may do is, shall we say, internationalize systemic risk issues that now are more fully contained within the U.S. economy.
Indeed, it will be interesting. And on a sort of opposite side of this coin, another so-called cause of the financial crisis is related to abuses in securitization. And so we're going to solve that problem by requiring financial institutions, at least with respect to securitizations that don't fit within certain safe boxes, to retain risks associated with those securitizations. Again, sort of another interesting aspect of this. Some risks we're going to push out and push them out into unregulated entities. Other risks, which were out in unregulated entities, we're going to pull back because we think it's safer to have them in the financial system than out. So I think we're going to see a lot of sort of interesting permutations of this risk stuff as this legislative process goes forward. One item I should mention is this legislative process, whenever it ends, is only the beginning, because whatever happens, we will have years of regulation and an awful lot of sorting out after the fact. So this stuff is going to be with us for a long time. It should carry Bert, Peter, and I well into retirement.
And John, a very important point on that in terms of how Congress addresses these issues is the extent to which they give the regulators the flexibility through the rulemaking process to, if you will, knock off some of the rough edges of this legislation and adapt to marketplace and legal realities.
Indeed. Bert, let's move, if we can, to some of the other provisions of the legislation, I think, that are they're really pretty interesting and actually very important for our financial system.
Well, let me begin by talking about consumer financial protection. And, you know, first of all, one of the things that's interesting is the difference in structure between the House bill, which envisioned creating an independent consumer financial protection agency, and the Senate legislation, which as it now stands would create a Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection within the Federal Reserve. And yet it's really within the Fed in name only, in that the head of this agency would be appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate, as if it was an independent regulator, would be able to operate independently of the oversight from the Fed Board of Governors, and would have, from a funding standpoint, access to 10% of the Fed's operating expenses. So it would really be kind of housed within the Fed, but not part of the Fed, and it raises some very interesting questions about accountability with regard to its expenditures, and that is something that I hope will be addressed. The Fed, for that reason alone, the independence within the Fed is very much opposed to this this particular structure. Now the CFP, the Consumer Financial Agency, would have a substantial rulemaking authority, but it could be overridden by a two-thirds vote of the the Federal Stability Oversight Council that that Peter mentioned. And this provision is intended to address a concern that many have raised, and that is that the Consumer Financial Protection Organization will actually create financial stability problems by having too much of a, shall we say, a consumer tilt, and it would put rules in place that would be dangerous to the financial health of those that it regulates. Another aspect of this is very important, and that is in terms of who it would have enforcement powers over. As now specified, it would be the examiner with regard to consumer activities and rulemaking for institutions with more than $10 billion of assets. This is a carve-out, if you will, for the community banks who would still be regulated with regard to consumer protection matters by their primary prudential regulator. So we get a bifurcation between large and small, and then, of course, raises lots of questions about the evenness of enforcement across finance institutions of various sizes. Another major important issue is going to be who is this going to apply to and who will it not? We have seen, for instance, a significant lobbying effort initiated by the automobile dealers to be exempt from this. This may be partially facetious, but a concern that orthodontists, who oftentimes provide dental services on some kind of installment payment basis, might be covered. And then, of course, there are the issues with regard to payday lenders and the like. So a major aspect, very controversial aspect of this aspect of the FIN legislation is over whom will the CFP have enforcement powers and who will be exempt. And then, of course, another major issue of contention is the whole issue of federal preemption. As it now stands in the Senate bill, the intent is to roll the federal preemption, specifically as it applies to national banks, back to what is known as the Barnett standard, which is a specific Supreme Court case in this regard. So this becomes another major issue here is the, if you will, the interaction between federal law and state law and the enforcement thereof. If I could just, so we have time for questions, just touch on a few other issues. Another one is the whole issue of restructuring the federal bank regulatory agencies. Both houses provide for the effectively the elimination of the Office of Thrift Supervision, and by merging it into the comptroller of the of the currency. The Senate bill would not abolish the thrift charter, but prohibit the issuance of new thrift charters. And presumably, then the remaining thrift charters would eventually disappear through conversion and acquisition. One aspect of this, that with regard to the regulatory agencies, is potentially going to be very confusing and again create problems of unequal enforcement of the law. It deals with the division or realignment of supervisory responsibilities between the OCC, the Fed, and the FDIC. That basically the Fed would have supervisory authority over financial institutions with more than $50 billion of assets. Federally chartered banks and thrifts would be, and their holding companies, less than $50 billion in assets would be under the OCC, and then the FDIC would have the same authority with state chartered banks and thrifts and their holding companies, again under $50 billion. So, in effect, holding company supervision would be spread across these three agencies, and of course, one of the interesting questions that comes up is what happens around the $50 billion mark, and to what extent will companies try to game the system either by staying under 50 or trying to get over 50, and then also flipping back and forth between federal and state charters as they do now. Just to touch on a couple of other areas that the bill addresses. One, with regard to the FDIC, the bills in both houses would now change the assessment base for deposit insurance to total assets minus tangible capital from domestic deposits. The effect of this is to shift the FDIC deposit insurance burden more onto larger banks. Interestingly, though, all of the losses that the FDIC is been taking have been in smaller banking companies. The largest failure in recent years is a $25 billion bank, but the community banks appear to have been successful in that regard. The legislation will provide some type of provision with regard to stockholder say on pay. The another one that is interesting that the Federal Reserve is fighting quite a bit, and that is to make the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York a presidential appointee subject to Senate confirmation. This, along with the notion of putting the Consumer Financial Protection Agency within the Fed, really represents a significant change in the Federal Reserve, in the coherency of the Fed. Finally, one other area I wanted to touch on with regard to the credit rating agencies. There's obviously been a lot of criticism of them and their contribution to the crisis. It not only would strengthen SEC regulation of the credit rating agencies, but also create a private right of action against the credit rating agencies. There are differences between the House and Senate bills in that regard, and so that is something that will have to be worked out in conference. John, let me cut it off there, and we'll see, have any discussion and open up the questions.
Yeah, there are a couple of interesting things. I mean, Bert, I'd love to get your reaction to this statement in the sort of Senate summary about the bank regulation. It says this bill will streamline bank supervision with clear lines of responsibility, reducing arbitrage, improving consistency and accountability. For the first time, there'll be clear lines of responsibility among bank regulators. I do find it interesting. They talk about how we had we have a convoluted system created by historical accident. We're now going to have sort of theoretically three regulators, the FDIC, the OCC, and the Fed. The Fed will have within it a consumer protection regulator essentially operating on its own. We have this $50 billion cutoff for holding companies, and we have the dual banking system still preserved. If this is clear, clear lines of responsibility, reduced arbitrage, and improved consistency, you know, more power to them, I guess.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because I try to explain the U.S. bank regulatory system to particularly folks from other countries, to me, the present system has a certain rationality to it when you look at it in terms of how it's evolved historically. When I look at what is proposed now, even my mind gets confused about how all this is going to play out. And, of course, it's going to raise interesting questions with regard to gaming, particularly for the under 50 billion companies in terms of not just whether they have a federal charter or state charter, but also in the context of the federal or state either the OCC or Fed OCC or FDIC regulation of any related holding company.
Yep, it's going to be interesting.
Keeps lots of lawyers very busy.
And on the credit rating agency, instead of sort of reducing the inherent oligopoly, the government sanctioned oligopoly, you know, that's still there, and we have some tinkering around the edges with respect to conflicts of interest and independent information and disclosure, and the liability issue is a big issue. The private right of action, I find interesting. Peter,
I think of course, one of the things that comes up there is the fact that the rating agencies do have a longstanding First Amendment defense, and even in when the issuer is paying for the ratings. And as I see it, through the private right of action provision, they're trying to get at that. But nonetheless, it's going to be interesting to see how that gets resolved vis-a-vis the challenges that are now underway in the courts against the First Amendment defense that the rating agencies have had.
Yep. And then my sort of last general comment, just sort of curious, interesting how the Senate summary describes the Federal Reserve revisions that you talked about as being provisions that strengthen the Federal Reserve. I'm not sure the Fed would read those quite the same way.
Well, they don't, and it has been interesting how aggressive various officials of the Fed, notably the presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve banks, have been in opposing these measures. And I think that we may see these watered down quite a bit because they really kind of fragment, if you will, the Fed quite a bit. The other thing that I wonder about is this 10% funding provision for this Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. That is a very large blank check, and
yep.
I would wonder if the appropriators, that is the members of the House and Senate Appropriations Committee, might have some difficulty with the arbitrariness of the funding for, and the extent that that funding would be outside the normal congressional appropriation process.
If you think about it from that point of view, this is a very, very troubling precedent, because one of the things Congress is always looking for is an opportunity to fund things without having to go through the budget process, without having to go through the appropriations process. Fannie and Freddie were examples of this. And if what we're now embarked on is a way of putting various costs into the Federal Reserve before the Federal Reserve has to return any money to the taxpayers at the end of each year, we'll be in serious trouble.
Well, that's why I think it will be interesting to see what the appropriators say about that. Well, the Fed has been off-budget agency, and there's been a lot of mystique about its monetary policy activities, and that's been the rationale for exempting it from the appropriations process. This is certainly, as consumer financial protection has absolutely nothing to do with monetary policy. And, so then the question comes up, what is the rationale for exempting this particular type of policing and regulatory activity from any oversight by the appropriators?
Indeed, I won't answer that question. We should, though, speaking of questions, we have about 10 minutes left. Let's open it up for questions and see if there are any. I noted that Peter mentioned the F words, Fannie and Freddie, not included in the bill, notwithstanding their contribution to the crisis.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is Gene Reuter. Let me go ahead and open the floor for Q&A. For those of you who are participating, you're going to hear a prompt that the floor mode is on to request the floor, that is to ask a question. You need to enter star and then pound on your telephone. Then we're going to answer the questions, take the questions in the order that they're received. When we get to your request, you're going to hear a prompt that says your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor, and at that point you can go ahead and ask your question. So let's begin that process now. So again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then pound on your telephone, and we'll go to the first question when we receive it. In the meantime, John and Peter, well, we actually have our first question, so there is no meantime. So let's go to that first question.
Gentlemen, Wayne Abernathy here. I want to ask a question about the resolution process. I think you've correctly pointed out there have been some improvements made. I think the clawback is an important provision. But my question is really, how will the markets perceive this? I think it's less of a legal issue of when an institution fails, can they, how are people treated, as the more ongoing consequence of how will the markets react. If the markets don't interpret this system as being putting everybody on the same level, and instead interprets that there are basically some new GSEs or some new favorite institutions, then it probably won't have succeeded and will end up increasing concentration and mispricing risk and all sorts of other things. Appreciate your comments on that.
Yeah, I think that's the key question, of course. And the thing that was most worrisome about the original plan that came out of the Senate Banking Committee before it was amended was exactly that, and that is that these institutions that are likely to be handled under a resolution process would be favored in the sense that their creditors would be in better shape, would get more than their creditors might get in an ordinary bankruptcy. So, assuming that this legislation goes all the way through in its current form and becomes law, I think that there will be a reduction in that possibility. I think there has been some substantial change in the way people will look at this, notwithstanding the fact that this whole clawback idea is going to be very difficult. The elimination of the $50 billion advance fund, which certainly would have encouraged its use, certainly would have been a continuous example before the eyes of creditors that some of these larger companies might well they might receive much better treatment as creditors of large companies than small ones. But I think in general, the change has been for the better. It's not perfect, but it's made some improvement over what would have been the case before.
There is an interesting argument to be made that by virtue of the sort of Chapter 7 liquidation provision, that you're treating the larger institutions perhaps worse than you might treat a large non-financial institution or a large institution not subject to this. The idea being that if you could reorganize under Chapter 11, you have the authority to preserve assets and asset values on a going concern basis. And that if, in fact, what you're talking about in terms of a Chapter 7 liquidation is a true liquidation, sell the assets as a bankruptcy trustee, you may wind up getting less than you would otherwise. Again, this is such a nebulous process, and it will be very hard to know how it plays out in practice.
John, if I could jump in here on that. You know, one of the things that I find very troubling about the bill is this whole notion of having a Chapter 7 type of liquidation. In bankruptcy, the preference is to reorganize in 11 because the liquidation process destroys economic value, destroys going concern value.
Yep.
And I find this that what we have here is a revision that seems to be driven as much by anger and retribution and not economic good sense. And I think that this should be very troubling from a public policy perspective, but also to the extent that we get uncertainty as to who this will apply to, it seems, and given the, shall we say, the punitive nature of a Chapter 7 type of liquidation, that this injects some unnecessary uncertainty into the markets that will boost funding costs for these larger companies.
And the rating agencies have already indicated potential downgrades of these institutions for that reason. So it would be interesting.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Well, the floor mode is still on. If you'd like to ask a question of any of our panelists, please push the star and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll know that you'd like to ask a question. In the meantime, Mr. Abernathy, do you have a follow-up? Or?
I think Wayne may have dropped off the phone, but let me, this is Bert, if I can just jump in on Fannie and Freddie. There has been a push by the Senate Republicans, perhaps more for political purposes than anything else, to try and get something into the bill on the resolution of Fannie and Freddie. But I think the fundamental problem there is that no one really has a very convincing case as to what should be done with Fannie and Freddie. And of course, the Obama administration has essentially punted on into at least next year on what to do with them, and of course in the meantime they continue to lose substantial amounts of money, and so that is perhaps the reason why this legislation will not deal with Fannie and Freddie, even though it should, because there's absolutely no consensus about what to do with them.
Well, the proposal for Fannie and Freddie is to start them on termination phase in about 2 years, as I recall. It's an amendment by John McCain, and the idea is that we'll get started on the process of eliminating them, and it within a 2-year period, extendable, of course, if they can't be eliminated at that time. But at least I think the idea is to put the Democrats on record that Fannie and Freddie will go out of business at some point. And whether that would actually pass the Senate is a real question.
Okay, well, John, I don't see an indication that there are any more questions. You want to have maybe 60 seconds from each speaker on final thoughts, and then we'll adjourn?
Peter, anything you'd like to say to close?
No, only that this is, for all of the talk we've had about the fact that this legislation has many unanswered questions in it, one of the things that I think if you look at the legislation as a whole, you'd conclude is that we are in danger of doing serious damage to the world's most innovative and successful financial system. When this bill passes, the United States will be on a trajectory downward from being the leading financial nation in the world. This is a very, very troubling piece of legislation.
John, this is Bird. Just to completely reinforce what Peter says, not only will it send us in this downward trajectory, but if past history holds in terms of how long it takes to fix flawed legislation, Glass-Steagall reform being a very good example, to the extent that this does occur, as I think it will, it's going to be very difficult to reverse direction, and what may happen in the meantime is that a lot of financial activity and innovation will be pushed into other markets, such as Toronto or London or Singapore, and once that activity is moved, it will be slow to bring it back to the United States, and so we have to realize that correction of policy errors in this legislation will be slow and difficult to achieve.
I think we can make a strong case that every time we enact legislation in response to a crisis, we create the seeds for the next crisis. One can go back to FIREA and some of the things embodied in FIREA and FIDICIA and see how those have played out in this crisis, as we've had a very strict sort of scheme of capital regulation. It'll be interesting to see how the seeds created in this one play out in the next crisis. And so life will be interesting for all of us. Dean, I think with that, we're done, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. This has been very informative. Thank you very much for your thoughts on this, and thanks to all the callers for dialing in. Let me just ask for feedback if people would like to send us an email on this presentation or others that have dialed into. You can send that to nfip@fed-soc.org. And let me also invite you to check out our website this morning with a lot of new information on today's breaking story. President Obama's appointment or nomination of Elena Kagan to the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.